Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Right, so tonight being the Upasada, we are getting ready to take a day off on Sunday, a day off from the world. It is kind of a day on the clock in terms of our Buddhist practice, and do a day long. And the theme will be intention, and taking a lot of time to look at intention. It's been very fruitful for many of us, and it's just been this ongoing theme. And every week we come to it from new perspectives, because as it turns out, it's not a simple thing. Action, in a way, is more straightforward, like our bodily action. Either we do the thing that's bad, or we do the thing that's good, or we simply don't do the thing that's bad, even though we want to. There's kind of only so many flavors of it, and it's easy enough to say what things are bad and what things are not bad. When it comes to speech, we say there's four kinds of unwholesome speech. That is to lie or to insult or to gossip or to chatter needlessly, and kind of everything else is various degrees of okay. Some things are really good, like really kind speech. Most speech could just be kind of neutral. Hence, you tend that, monastics and people on retreat just try to speak less, because you make a lot less mistakes if you're not speaking at all. You just keep quiet. But when we get into intention, we get into the mind. And this is where we're dealing with something that the mind has no form, the mind has no substance, it isn't located anywhere in space and time. And so time is irrelevant, space is irrelevant, form is irrelevant. How do we talk about it? How do we classify it? How do we make any sense of what's going on when we can't see it, when we can't measure it? And so this is the conundrum. And sort of if you were to think, the Buddha said in terms of the realms of existence, and he talks about the human realm and the realm of ghosts and the hell realms and the heavenly realms with floating angelic beings. And he says of all the realms that he could perceive, there's no realm or state of birth that beings are born into more diverse than the animal realm. Which is lucky for us, because it's actually one we have experience with. It's actually one we can most, I assume most people can see. We don't know anything about the ghosts and the other realms, but animals, yes. And I think most people can agree there's a lot of diversity in the animal realm. And now you think by the time we are adults, we're pretty familiar with a lot of different forms of animals. And I mean, this is part of training. What is the first thing? As soon as a child is learning words, you teach them this is a dog, it goes woof. This is a cat, it goes meow. You're like training them to recognize all of the stuff going on around them. And even in the animal realm, which has so many different forms, we can try to categorize things. But there's no perfect system, right? It's all arbitrary, or it's all we make up the system. Likewise, when we look at the mind, we've kind of just got to make up a system, because the Buddha said, similarly to the animal realm, where I mean, that thing has eight legs, and that thing has no legs, and that thing has 1,000 legs, and that thing, I don't even know what it has going on. Likewise with the mind, some thoughts move towards something, some move away, some are angry, some are spiteful, some are conceited, some lie, some tell the truth. How do we make any sense of it? And so the Buddha kind of invents a classification system, and that's what we go with. And this is how we start to look at the mind. And so The classification system that the Buddha offers us is based on what he calls wholesome and unwholesome roots. And this is a system throughout the Buddha's teaching. It starts with the roots, I think, mula is the word in Pali that's used in the Theravada, but it gets becomes the poisons, I think, in maybe Tibetan Buddhism. So there's a lot of different ways that it's classified, but it tends to be these three, and that is greed, hatred, and delusion. And then we have wholesome mind states, which are, you know, non-greed or generosity, non-hatred or benevolence, and non-delusion or wisdom. And so this is the system that the Buddha offers. And like any classification we could come up with in the animal realm, it's kind of arbitrary, but it has a point. And the point is to give us some way to make sense of what our mind is doing and where that's coming from. Like, where did that response come from? Like, what is that thought about? And to classify it so that we can start deciding what we want to do with it. Because our decisions are part of our mind. Our choices are part of our mind. And this is what intention is all about. We see what's going on, and we can kind of see the effect of our mind states. We can perceive our perception. We know how we are seeing the world. And by the time that we see it, it's already a little late. But what we can do is decide how we want to react to that. And the way that we react to our perceptions, to our feelings, to our habits, to the thoughts that are arising in our mind, sets the stage for the next set of thoughts, the next set of perceptions. And this is the way that intention works. We respond to things, and we intend for things to go a certain way. And this is where the teaching on the roots or the poisons really starts to shine, because we can start to sense where our mind state is coming from, and we can predict where things will go if we keep cultivating that mind state. If we reinforce the pattern that's already arising, we're going to continue to get a certain kind of result. And if we don't like where that mind state is going, then we should do something about it. You know, we should alter our intention, alter our perception even, try to see things in a different way. And by doing so, we can't really change the thought that just arose, but we can start to influence what'll come next, what'll happen in the future. Maybe some thoughts and patterns are very sticky. Maybe it takes a lot of working on our perceptions and working on our feelings and working on our habits to change the momentum so that new kinds of thoughts arise. But it's worthwhile, yeah? Because again, the project in Buddhism is suffering. If we didn't suffer, if we didn't feel anxiety, if we didn't feel regret, if we didn't, you know, do things that caused pain for ourselves and for others, then we wouldn't need practice. We wouldn't have anything to cultivate. We're already fine. We're already good. There's no problem. But because, I mean, I don't know, you're all here. You're here because of suffering. If everything was going good, then you wouldn't be here. Yeah. But as human beings, we can just say that, yeah, there's all sorts of things I'm uncomfortable with, and I don't like feeling uncomfortable. Is there anything I can do about discomfort? Yeah. And people of the world, they not perceiving the ability to alter mind states, not perceiving the ability to alter intention, they are just swept along by it. And this is why the unwholesome roots are said to go so deep. If you don't realize that you can pull them out and that they can cease, they can nirodha or end without remainder, then you're just trapped by them, and they will continue to have their way with your mind, and they will get stronger and develop and cause all sorts of suffering in your life. So I thought tonight, maybe just take a quick look at each of these. And part of this comes because of recognizing a taboo. And when you get out in the world as a Buddhist practitioner, and maybe you all don't have this problem because maybe you go to the store and people look at you and they don't see, that's a Buddhist. That person meditates. They can't tell. But I kind of can't get away with it. I go walking through the world and people see me and they're like, that's probably, he's doing something. That thing he's wearing, that probably wasn't an accident. I don't know, maybe, not sure, but probably the shaved head means something. Why is he wearing sandals? It's really cold out. Like something's going on here. And so they surmise that I'm Buddhist. And I get to talking, I talk about the Dhamma, I talk about, the Buddha, I talk about the Sangha, things I'm interested in. We find that when I talk about things that to meditators seem very obvious, like greed, hatred, and delusion, some people kind of pucker up. Yeah. And this is what I mean by a taboo. In the world, if you believe that, if you don't realize you have the ability to change your mind, if you believe that you are your thoughts, if you believe that your psyche is you, then the idea of greed, the idea of hatred, the idea of delusion is incredibly threatening because it implies that you are broken. It implies that you are impure. And if you believe that you are a static thing, this is a disaster. You would much rather just not talk about it. Yeah. And this is the way that most of the world works. They don't talk about these things unless they're talking about somebody else doing it. Yeah. So greed is something that used car salesmen have. Greed is something that politicians have. Greed is something that corporate business people have. But greed is not something that regular people have. And even the word greed, we tend to not think of it as a normal state of mind, right? It's like, oh, greed, that's a serious thing. Like I'm just hungry. Yeah, I just want that particular dish at the restaurant. It's not greed. Greed is like I grab it and run out of the store and run away with it, right? Similarly with hatred. Yeah, it's an intense word. Who has hatred? Well, it's militants in Africa, or some sort of parades of people going down your local city, like getting in fights and mobs and all of these things. Those are people who have hate. I just don't like that guy. Yeah, that's not hate. He's a jerk. So I'm totally justified in not liking him. Yeah, but it's not hate. And delusion, where do we go with that? Who's going to be willing to admit they have delusion? Well, meditators tend to admit that they've got delusion because the first thing that happens when you sit down to meditate is you start to try to follow your breath and you realize you can't. You follow in breath, out breath. What am I doing after this? What just happened? In breath, oh man, my foot really hurts. Yeah, we realize that our mind is cloudy, is messy, is distorted, is shadowy. Yeah. But delusion, I mean, that sounds like something you get locked away for. That sounds like something that needs a medication to deal with it, right? But the Buddha is not teaching these things as these rarefied mental states. Yeah, the essence of these roots is that they are a way of categorizing our basic mental states. Yeah, similarly, if we're categorizing animals and we said, well, only animals that are blue are going to go in this category, well, it wouldn't be a very useful category because there's a ton of animals that are all sorts of different colors, right? And if greed only dealt with like really intense states of infatuation, it wouldn't be a good category. So when we say greed, we're actually talking about all of the mental states that come from a particular source, and that source is the liking of an object, the appreciation, the attraction, the attention to the sign of the beautiful in an object. Yeah. And this is any mental state that derives itself, whether in the present moment or from, you know, the habit energy of continually developing that state of appreciation or fixation or obsession, depending on how deep it becomes. All of those go in the category of greed when they deal with trying to get that thing. Yeah. And so there, I just showed an important facet of this is all states of greed are rooted in the idea of a self. They all derive from the ignorance of that you exist. Yeah. If we could just see an object and not be in the scenario, then there would be no greed. But the moment we perceive an us and we perceive a beautiful object, there is a wanting of the beautiful object, yeah? So what is non-greed? Well, non-greed still derives from the same source, yeah? It is still, say we have a wholesome state like generosity, there is still an idea of self in this, yeah? So there is still an appreciation of the object. This, my trusty pen, this is a really good pen, yeah? It's a really good pen. But somebody asked me for the pen and I'm like, here you go. Now this is generosity, this is non-greed, yeah? Because I believe it's a good pen, I appreciate the pen, and so, but I'm still willing to give it up, yeah? There is no attraction, there's no movement towards it, there's no holding on to it, there's no identifying with it as my pen, be sure you give it back. It's like, no, here, yeah? And these are wholesome mind states, but these wholesome mind states like generosity are still rooted in the idea of appreciation. Yeah. So what is beyond these two categories? Well, it would be the noble eightfold path. It would be, you know, the complete non-greed, which we try to cultivate, which is to not even develop the idea of self, not even to develop an appreciation towards objects. When the appreciation, when the enticement, when the sense of beautification completely falls away from the object still exists, but there's no basis for greed. There is no production of self, yeah? So if the idea of a self falls away, then there's no way to really perceive something as beautiful. How could it be beautiful? How could it be pleasant? How could it be useful if you don't exist? Yeah, something is beautiful because it's useful to you. Something is beautiful because you appreciate it, yeah? But when that falls away, there is no longer any basis for greed and no basis for moving towards that object. So we find that the cessation of the root of greed is the cessation of appreciating objects. It's a cessation of delighting in objects, yeah? And that's where greed stops without remainder. And when it stops without remainder, all of the various problems that we have associated with this mind state also cease without remainder. They were dependent on them. So what states will disappear? Well, greed is our category, right? But it's like, it's like saying, you know, animals that have legs. It's a very broad category. Yeah. And that includes, you know, deer and it includes centipedes, right? Likewise with greed, there are many words that we use in the Pali canon that deal with greed. Lobha is the one that we tend to think of, we tend to use with the root, and that being kind of greed or acquisitiveness. Covetousness is the lengthy English word that they tend to use in translating it, coveting something. But there's also raga, which tends to be more kind of a lusty connotation, like lusting for an object, like really wanting an object. And then we have words like chanda, which feel a lot more neutral. It's sort of like a wanting or being interested in something. Yeah. And finally, we have tanha, or thirsting for something, right? All of these fall within the category of greed. So when we're looking at our intention, we can ask ourselves, do I think I exist in this scenario? Probably. It takes a lot of work to get over the idea that I'm part of it. Do we appreciate the object? Do we see it as beautiful? Do we see it as pleasant? Do we see it as something that we could want? And do we feel ourselves inclining towards it? And it can be any of these flavors of greed or appreciation, of interest, of lust, of wanting, of desire, of thirst. All of those we would say are greed. And if though we appreciate it, we're still willing to give it away, to let it go, to just, let anybody have it, then we would say it's generosity. Once that a sense of appreciation falls away, it's non-greed. There's no more tendency. There's no more intention being formed. Yeah, this is not going to lead anywhere. The second one, we have hatred, and we tend to say dosa when we talk about the root. But there's other words that we use, like vyapada, and vyapada means ill will. And it like literally means ill will. So wishing ill is a kind of, and we do. You're like, may that person feel bad. And if you check in, this you we do have these thoughts. It's like, may they get theirs. May they get their comeuppance. Often we're having a bad time when we experience this mental state. And often we want others to also have a bad time when we experience this mental state. Another word that's used is vera, and vera's closer to a kind of hating or anger. Koda is another word in Pali, which is actual like aggressive, like anger. Yeah. And all of these fall within the purview of hatred. Yeah, but all of these derive from the source of disliking something, and that is seeing something as unpleasant, seeing something as unattractive, basically attending to the sign of the repulsive or unattractive aspect of something can incline the mind to want to push it away, to get rid of it, to be averse to that thing. Yeah. Naturally, to get away from something, it means you're there. Yeah, if it's just the thing by itself, then you don't, there's nothing to get away from. But if you perceive yourself as existing, well, then something nasty is something you want to get rid of. Now, all of these mental states derive from this source. Yeah, when we experience something that we dislike, that we find unpleasant, that we want to get rid of, this would be anger. And what happens when we see something as unpleasant, but we don't push it away, we don't shun it, we don't hate it, we don't think it's a blight on our existence, we don't wish it were not there, we don't wish it didn't exist. Well, this would be, states of non-hatred. Often we think of loving kindness or benevolence as being the complete opposite, like dealing with, oh, I actually like that person, I actually love that person. But when we start to understand the roots, we realize that, well, loving kindness, when we like really like love and appreciate and beautify the person, that's a lot more like what we're doing with greed, isn't it? Yeah. Actually, like the counter to hatred is more of seeing the thing as it is. Because if you see something as it is, you see its blemishes. Yeah. Like I've got a little spot on my head. I don't even know what that is. Yeah. But so I'm not perfect, but do you form a dislike? You're like, could you? Yeah. If you could turn your, yeah, there we go. It's gone. Yeah. No problem anymore. Yeah. Or do we just like, wow, you're perfect the way that you are. Yeah. You don't need to change at all. Your good parts, your bad parts, they're all part of the package. And that's wonderful. Now, that is benevolence. That is loving kindness. Yeah. That is goodwill to appreciate the being, even though they have faults. You let that be in your environment. You don't push it away. You don't shun it. You're like, oh, this is great. A lot of our humor is based on this goodwill, right? And what do comedians talk about? They talk about stuff that's kind of unpleasant. Yeah, they talk about bad airline food, and they talk about the strange guy at the bus stop, and they talk about, what the politician just said. They're talking about things that should be unpleasant, but they are not pushing it away. They're saying, look at that. That's funny. That's ironic. Yeah, and it becomes pleasant all of a sudden. It becomes funny. Yeah, we're like, oh, haha, that's right. I don't have to experience suffering about that. I don't have to hate that thing. All of this is in this category of hate. And so I encourage you to look at all of the ways that you might experience aversion and to ask, is there some way I can just not push this away, not shun this, not try to get away from this? And would that start to resolve a lot of the problem? Yeah. Because when we can coexist with something, it's not really hate anymore, right? It's something more akin to tolerance or goodwill. Now, where does this cease without remainder? Well, it's when there is no more attending to the sign of the repulsive or the unbeautiful. Yes, no more attending to the unattractiveness of the thing. You no longer see it as unpleasant. You no longer see it as a problem. Yeah. And when you no longer see it as a problem, when you no longer perceive yourself in relationship to it, as trying to get away or avoid or make it not exist, well, lo and behold, it ceases without remainder. There is no more basis for hatred. There's no more basis for any of these mind states of disliking. Yeah. And these two states, greed and hatred, categorize most of the way that we relate to the things in our world. Our world, we call it the sense world, the Kamaloka. And this is because we experience it through our senses. Yeah, we have the eye, we have the ear, we have the nose, the tongue, and our body, our tactile sense. And based on this, we have a brain and we have a mental sense that tries to churn over all of the previous senses it's experienced in its lifetime. And based on these six senses, we have all sorts of movement towards things and away from things. Yeah. All of basically what we deal with in the sensual world is probably going to be one of these two states. But when we transcend these, when we really get past these, we find there's a whole category of mental states that don't fall in these two categories. Yeah, they don't necessarily deal with objects. And that's how you can know their flavor. And so we have the root that we call delusion or moha. But this is a kind of catch-all for mental states which attend to the neither pleasant nor unpleasant aspect of something. They deal with objects, but in a particular way. Yeah, they deal with thoughts, but in a particular way. They deal with perceptions, but in a particular way. And that is, they are pointless. Whereas people who are really attracted to something, they have a goal, right? They want to get that thing. People who hate something have a goal. They want to get that thing away from them. They want to make it go away. They want to get away from it. Yeah, but with delusion, we have states of not attending to things, not caring, not having a goal, not being focused. Yeah. And these are all of the states that lead to laziness, torpor, confusion. So there's so many mental states that deal with just being gray to the scenario in front of us. And often somebody who deals with a lot of these deluded mental states is kind of out of touch with things. Yeah. And that's the nature of these mind states. But they go beyond that because we'll see with things like conceit or even deceit. that this category deals with all of the ways that we try to say something is other than it is. Yeah, we try to not attend to the object, or we try to say the object is something different than what it actually is. And this is otherwise known as a lie. Yeah, and so all of the ways that we try to avoid the reality of something or change the reality of something also fall in this category. And that because we are not just experiencing the object as it is, or experiencing the thought or the feeling or the emotion as it is, there is this aspect of unclarity that comes with it. Yeah. Most of our restlessness, most of our inability for the mind to just relax, will come from a variety of these mental states of delusion working their way in there. Because if we really are just at ease and attentive to what's going on in the world, we call that mindfulness. It's a kind of pleasant, relaxed, calm, beautiful, in touch, full-bodied, wholesome mental state, right? And this is the non-delusion aspect. When we are in touch with an object and we are not attending to either its pleasant or its unpleasant aspect, but we're really attending to the object, but we still perceive ourselves as existing. Yeah, we still, I'm here. That's there. This is reality. This is reality. This is real. This is really happening. Yeah. We have a state where there's still the basis for, you know, ignorance. There's still the basis for an idea of self, but there is no tuning out. There is no, there's no shunning. There's no turning away from. There's no denying. It's like, yeah, I'm not deluded. Most meditators will be like, I'm so deluded. I don't know what to do. Yeah, because that's a pretty real assessment. We've got a lot going on up here, yeah? And a lot of it is off the mark. Yeah, we're not always seeing things as they actually are. Yeah. But when we know that, when we're in tune with that, we have states of non-delusion, we have states of mindfulness, states of clarity, states of coherence. And I don't know, I find that really uplifting, just the idea of coherence. But then again, I've dealt with a lot of delusion in my own mind, and I've been keeping track of it for quite a while. And yeah, it's quite a scorecard. But just thinking about being coherent, being clear, making sense, being in touch with things, that sounds like a real win, right? That sounds like something to actually work towards. It's not an accident. And that's one of the real tragedies of not believing in mental training, not believing in the ability to develop the mind, is that you never get to improve in these ways. You just assume either you're awake or you're not awake. And if you're not awake, then maybe I'll drink some coffee and that will make me more attentive. It doesn't work that way. Yeah? If you're deluded and you drink a cup of coffee, you will be deluded faster. You'll be just as deluded, but you'll be getting more delusion done. Yeah, it doesn't solve the problem of delusion. But if you slow down, often it does. If you get more in touch with things, if you get more calm and more clear, often it does solve many of the problems that come with delusion. You start to see the things that you're missing. Where does delusion cease without remainder? And this is where the Noble Eightfold Path and the cultivation that the Buddha talks about and points to really starts to shine. Because when we uproot the idea of a self, we categorically uproot the idea of suffering, all of the basis of suffering. Only a self, only a me, mine, you know, this I am, only that can suffer. You know, again, good little pen, it never suffers. Yeah. It just exists. Yeah. And there can be mental states where we kind of let go of the whole subjective side of things. It's not about me. I'm not in this scenario. This is just happening. Yeah. This is just reality. And when there's just reality without the attending to the beautiful or the unbeautiful, without the tuning out to it, there can come mental states where there's no lack of clarity. about me or mine, or what am I getting out of this, or what am I doing in 10 minutes when the guy stops talking so I can get on with the rest of my evening. None of that is happening anymore. Yeah. It just stops. And when it stops, there is no, it continues to stop until the gears start turning again, until we have a thought that deals with self. And that gets the gears turning, and we have another thought about self and another thought about self. But if we, through meditation, through contemplating the Dhamma, through relaxing, those start to cease, we might get to a place where there are large gaps, where we are not deluded, where we are just taking in the reality around us, but we are not, it's not about us. It's just, this is what's happening. Yeah. And this is also where, as we'll talk during the day long, and we've been talking over the last couple of weeks, this is where kamma or action, kamma being karma, that's where this ceases without remainder. Because if we're in tune with things, if we're okay with things, if we're accepting of things and we're not making a self out of it, then there is no volition, there is no intention, there is no action being done, because everything's already okay. If there's no suffering, then there's nothing to be done to get away from the suffering. And if there's nothing being done, then there's no further production of self, there's no further production of an existence that can suffer. And this is where the Eightfold Path directs us to a place where we are okay enough. Yeah, we have enough of the non-greed, the non-hatred, and the non-delusion that we can really just take our hands off the steering wheel, and we'll continue to coast in this straight and narrow, path ahead of us. Yeah, things will work, and there will not be suffering. Okay, so Asa, I encourage you to break the taboo, yeah? And call these three categories whatever you want to call them, whether this one is liking and this one's disliking and this one's being scatterbrained. It doesn't matter what we call them. They were given these high and lofty names because the Buddha, he didn't hold back, yeah? These categories do include some pretty nasty mental states. Yeah, but the wanting of a candy and the wanting of breaking into a bank and stealing all the money is still in the same category. Yeah, so when we say greed, we just look to the sign. Is there the sign of the beautiful, the sign of the attractive? When we think of hatred, we look, is there a sign of the unattractive, the sign of the repulsive? When we look to delusion, is there a sign of lack of clarity? Is there a sign of not attending to things? Is there a sign of not having a goal or an objective? Yeah. And this gives us something to work with. When we see the root, we see where the mind is coming from, we can already see where it's going to go, and we can do something about it. Yeah. So I offer this for your reflection tonight. I hope it's useful. Anything that's useful, take. And anything that's not useful, just set it aside. Yeah.